Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. This is the first program of the new season, the 2013-2014 season of Thursday Morning Roundtable. So I'm going to ask you all to try again. Some of you are new. And so the tradition is that in the morning I get up and say good morning, and then y'all say good morning back to me. And just in case I haven't fully awoken. All right, so I'm going to try that again. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Sandra Barrett, and it is my pleasure to welcome you here today on behalf of University College of Syracuse University. And as you know, this is the first program of the new season. We have a 13-week season. We have our season all lined up. I can assure you it's going to be varied. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be thought-provoking. It's going to be great. And in part, that's because you are going to be here and you're going to be asking great questions of the speakers and learning a lot. Speaking of the university, you all read this morning or heard that we have a new chancellor, chancellor-elect. We'll give him a chance to get here, and then we will back to Syracuse, and then we will certainly issue an invitation. But we are looking forward to introducing him to TMR. And if you hadn't read about it, his name is Kent Sievert, I think. And he comes to us via the University of Washington at St. Louis. And I'm trying to think, I read really quickly this morning. I was checking my iPhone. I have an iPhone now, just to make sure I hadn't had a call or an email from this morning speaker who I knew was coming back late last night from DC. So I was hoping I hadn't had a call from him. But instead I saw an email from the Board of Trustees chair. The three things I remember about the new chancellor are that he is the dean of the law school at the University of Washington, that he instituted the first online master's degree program in law. I thought that was impressive. That he is a native of upstate New York. And wait, one more thing, and that is that he is a thoughtful and collaborative leader. And so we're all about being thoughtful and collaborative. So again, big news. Of course, the other big news is international and national security. And although it's not a topic that we touch on a lot at Thursday Morning Roundtable, we keep a local focus. We have a lot of local and state issues to talk about. I'd like to say that I was prescient in thinking of and knowing what was going to be in the headlines this week when I asked Bob Murrett to speak. But in fact, it was a little bit about the connection with 9/11. That's always in our minds, that date, and today being the 12th. But anyway, it's my pleasure to introduce today's guest speaker, Vice Admiral Robert Murrett, who joined SU just a few years ago after a long and varied career in naval intelligence. He's had a dizzying number of assignments and commissions, and I could not even begin to commit any of them to memory, so I'm just going to read some of them. He has been the director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, Director of Naval Intelligence, an afloat intelligence officer, an assistant chief of staff, intelligence for the commander of the carrier group, director, intelligence director, and it goes on and on. But what is most important is that now he has come to us, come back to upstate, another upstate native, grew up in Buffalo, went to the University of Buffalo. He is now deputy director of the Institute for National Security and Counterterrorism, working with Bill Banks. Bill has been a speaker here before, you will remember, and also a professor of practice, public administration, and international affairs. So given what we have all been reading about in the news, I'm sure that we will have a lot of questions for him and look forward to hearing from Vice Admiral Bob Murrett. Thank you, Bob.
Good morning. It's good to be with all of you. And it is fairly timely. As Sandra mentioned, I was relieved that the plane did take off from National Airport last night around midnight and got us back here. But it's something that we're accustomed to, so it's not that unusual. As Sandra mentioned, we'll be welcoming our new chancellor at a small ceremony today, I think at 1 o'clock in Hendricks Chapel, Ken Saverud. She mentioned most of the background on him, but he did not mention one dark secret of his past that he and I share together. We both have degrees from Georgetown University. I don't know how much commotion that'll create, but Ken Saverud is a Hoya. He's a grad of Georgetown University. And now that we've shifted from the Big East to the ACC, that may not be quite as big a factor as it was before, but the... you know, once a year at the Maxwell School, just for the as a faculty member there in public administration, you do have to put on all the regalia, as they call it, for the ceremony, because the students do too, and they like you to do it. And I always get asked what this hood that I've got on my gown, which is blue and gray, represents, and I just don't tell anybody, so it's probably better that way. It's good to be with all of you. The topic for this morning's talk, and I'll just give some brief remarks and then turn it over to the audience for a Q&A, because I think that's probably the best part of these things. But the topic is intelligence, surveillance, and national security. And what I'd like to do in just, you know, about 10 or 15 minutes is talk about some of the big issues that we are dealing with in intelligence, surveillance, and national security, and kind of bring it back to Central New York. Because, as you know, Richard Haass's excellent book that some of you may have read from this year, national security begins at home. And there are important roles that Central New York has played in the past and continues to play and will play in the future relative to national security. And I'll give some specific examples of that, but try to tie in some of the global events that we're seeing that are taking place around the world, some of the recent commotion in the intelligence community. It's been all over the newspapers. And what that means for those of us that live here in Central New York, correct myself, and the importance of what it means for the Syracuse area and some of the institutions that we deal with here nearby. I'll start with not the intelligence surveillance, which I'll get to, but the national security portion, which are the three parts for the topic today. As you know, one of the things that our government has done really in the last, starting about 5 years ago, towards the end of the Bush administration, certainly at the start of the Obama administration, is to have a broader definition of national security. That's, you know, the topic for this morning. And our national security strategy that we have for the United States, which was signed out about 4 years ago and is still in effect, was kind of a linchpin document in terms of our definition of national security in ways that relate to this audience, to every one of us. The discussion, you know, national security has traditionally been viewed in fairly narrow terms by many countries in the past, largely in terms of military power, to some degree other things which are related to that, soft power, diplomacy, and so forth, but kind of with an emphasis on strength. And what we saw towards the end of the Bush administration and with the Obama administration, as I said, with our existing national security strategy signed out by the White House, is a much broader definition of national security. It includes things that folks don't traditionally associate with national security. Certainly the economy, it includes education, it includes healthcare, it includes the environment, and it includes the military and the intelligence apparatus, which I'll come back to, but it is a broader definition of national security in ways that affect everyone here in the room, and certainly those of us in Central New York. It is also, because it is a broader definition of national security and one that we can all, I think, have a pretty good discussion about, it's less, from a United States standpoint, it's less U.S.-centric and it's less Washington-centric. It's more about the entire nation and what is happening in all 50 of our states. And moreover, it's about the very important engagement and relationships that we need to have with our key allies around the world and all the family of nations through a variety of mechanisms. So I mentioned that because the one of the three topics today is national security. And I think we're continuing to see a transition of the definition of national security in ways that have more impact and everyone else that's here today. The second thing that's important, which is a kind of a deep argument, which we won't go into detail there, our national security strategy now for the United States also took a pretty big shift away from something which is not widely accepted around the world, and that is a whole section of our national security strategy that says that there is no distinction between interests and values. Typically in political history, certainly in the 17th to 18th century, particularly in the United Kingdom, for example, they make a big distinction between the interests of a country and what their values are. Our national security strategy says that our values are our interests, and that they cannot be distinguished. And the things that we stand for as Americans, what the United States represents around the world, represents our interests as well as our values, and you can't make a distinction between them. This is part of a broader, almost a philosophical discussion, but it's an important document that I think is being embraced more widely by people around the United States, and one that has big implications, and it's setting an example as much as we can, notwithstanding the security challenges that we have, which I'll talk about in just a minute. The challenges are there around the world, and I'll talk about Syria and NSA and some things here in a minute, but somebody mentioned to me many years ago, it's not easy being the United States. And we're seeing evidence of that. I mean, whether we want people to or not, they are going to look to us. And I think we have to measure that and certainly work very carefully with our allies. But, around the world, people still have a lot of expectations of us. And my wife, Judy, and I, we've been married for a very long time, have lived all over the world. And over and over again, you can't help but be impressed by, in spite of the pretty wide and deep criticism that we get from time to time, we seldom get ignored. And I'll talk about that in a second because of some of the security challenges that we're facing. There are a lot of things out there that we need to pay attention to. And most recently, the headlines have been, as you know, about Egypt and Syria, which I'll talk about in a little detail. But there are some other huge concerns that we have around the world that are perhaps more important than that and a little bit more strategic and less immediate than those that we've seen. Probably the biggest one is nuclear weapons. There are still around 18,000 nuclear weapons around the world, most of them in Russia. We're second in terms of the United States. Our own stockpile is in good shape, but the Russian stockpile is not in very good condition, primarily because of simple resource issues and the cost associated with looking after all of those nuclear weapons. If you talk to, I think, any real expert on national security, probably the biggest concern that we have around the world today. And it's something that has not gotten much attention, really, in the last 12 years because of concerns with counterterrorism and other things we've looked at. But the sheer volume of nuclear weapons that we still have around the world, most of which are fairly secure. There are concerns in Pakistan and India and certainly North Korea. But most of them are in fairly good condition from a security standpoint. They are not in very good condition from the standpoint of maintenance and upkeep and degradation of materials. So I just mentioned that because the whole nuclear issue is a very big one from the standpoint of national security, far more important than what's happening in Syria right now, quite frankly. Someone told me 10 years ago, and I've never forgotten this, when I was responsible for counterproliferation and accountability of Soviet and then Russian nuclear weapons, said, if a nuclear weapon ever goes off anywhere in the world for any reason, nobody's going to remember anything else about the intelligence community. And they're probably right. The other thing is that the Defense Science Board did a study on this two summers ago and came to the conclusion that it's most likely to happen just because of inattention more than anything else, as opposed to a terrorist-associated kind of Hollywood plot with a nuclear weapon. Any nuclear device that we have which would go off would most likely just because of an accident someplace in Russia today, because they have well into five figures of weapons and they're just not being looked after, primarily because it's so expensive today. So that's a big national security issue, and I mentioned it to this audience because it deserves more attention than it traditionally gets. We also have, from a geographic standpoint, huge challenges around the world. North Korea, territorial disputes in East Asia that involve many nations over there, not the least Japan and China, the Philippines, South Korea, and Vietnam and beyond. Pakistan, which is very worrisome. And we don't have time to go into details on all these, but really the swath of instability that exists all the way from Pakistan to Tunisia, including some of the places that we'll talk about here today. Iran, which is more promising now than it was a year ago because of the new leadership there, which looks like it wants to engage with us more, but some things related to their own nuclear program, which are worrisome. The drawdown in Afghanistan, the Iraqi and Syrian ungoverned and semi-governed area based upon things that have happened in the last year, and also some other developments that are happening in Africa and Latin America, which we don't have time to go into this morning, but a lot of security concerns around the world and ones that they look to the United States to be involved in one way or another, if only from the standpoint of diplomacy and engagement. Specifically, events in Syria, an absolute humanitarian catastrophe. The number of refugees that have actually had to leave, aside from the repopulation inside Syria, is more than 2 million. I heard just last week it's gone up to, I think, 40%. 40% of the population of Lebanon are Syrian refugees today. There are more than probably 800,000, approaching 1 million Syrian refugees in Jordan. And our, assurances for the security of Jordan are very, very important in the region. Kurdistan is being reformed in northern Iraq. A new state is emerging there. And to the south of that is, as I already alluded to, a semi-governed, ungoverned area which could become a safe haven for a lot of bad activity by Sunni extremists extending from Syria into Iraq. All these things have happened just in the past, starting about a year and a half ago, but in detail for the last 6 months, and it's gotten far more pronounced than it was beforehand. And it's continuing to kind of spin out of control just from the standpoint of the refugee crisis that we have over there. But I think the big lesson of all of this, without getting into the specifics, and as we alluded to earlier when I said it's not easy being the United States, is that as much as we may want to draw down our international engagement, certainly from the standpoint of military, but also from the standpoint of some of the other things that we're doing overseas, foreign aid perhaps, and so on, is that we don't fully control the level of engagement that we would like to have in international events. And we don't control things that are going to spool up in all parts of the world, whether it's East Asia, Africa, Latin America, in this case, the Middle East. And we also aren't that good at accurately predicting the places where we may be called upon to get engaged by our allies and by others around the world. That's something that will continue for many years into the future. A subset of our national security, of course, is also the intelligence apparatus that we have in the country. And I'd like to talk about that just for a second and then take your questions. As you know, there's been a lot of commotion recently regarding the National Security Agency, headed up by a Syracuse native, General Keith Alexander, who hails from these parts, went to high school here in Syracuse before he went to West Point, and his family has a lot of roots in this area. I don't think we need to get into the eaches of what has come out of, from a legal standpoint of the Patriot Act. Most of these things that have happened recently have to do with something called Section 215 of the Patriot Act, and two parts of it that have to do with internet monitoring and communications monitoring for telephone calls, primarily internationally, but also to some degree domestically, that cut across borders. But there are a couple of key points on this that I would make for the audience. The first point relative to what has happened to what I would call signals intelligence and all the revelations that have come out in the last several months since the Snowden affair came out is that all three branches of our government are involved in this. And all three branches, whether it's the FISA court, the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, or the administration, the National Security Council, and the National Security Agency, were pretty well informed about what was going on. There are probably some concerns within the judicial branch of our government relative to the FISA court. And having had to do a lot of hearings for both the Senate and the House, there are always more members and more staffers up on the Hill that want to know more about what's going on in the intelligence community. The process, just quickly, that we have in the United States is what are called the Big Eight on the Hill, which are the chairs and ranking members and the Speaker of the House and the Minority Leader, the Senate Majority and Minority Leader. They get briefed on just about everything. They get briefed just with them and without any staffers. And the concern that you see play out all the time on intelligence issues, as we're seeing now with NSA, is they always want the entire body to be briefed on things plus all the staff members. And if you do that, you tend to have leaks, quite frankly. Having said that, the Big Eight are informed and have been informed about what's going on given the amount of time that they have to spend on what are admittedly pretty complicated issues. There will be reforms. Changes are going to be made. There will be hearings by both the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the House Permanent Subcommittee, Permanent Committee on Intelligence, the HPSI. There will be changes probably made to the FISA court process, and that gets into a whole legal side of this, which you don't need to go into. And the administration has already started releasing a lot of documents related to this, although, to be honest, at this point, if they're, and they released another tranche from just 2 days ago on Tuesday, if releasing these documents has actually reassured people or just kind of raised concerns, it may have gone in the other direction. But I think the big takeaway is that all three branches of government have been involved in this and informed, and there are going to be changes made as a result of the revelations that we've seen that will affect our certainly the judicial side in terms of the FISA court and potentially legislation, although we don't know what this is going to look like, and the continued activity by the executive branch. A couple other points that are worth noting. The United States does conduct espionage operations of all sorts. Not just signals intelligence, but also geospatial imagery intelligence and human intelligence. And it's a key part of our national security. And that probably needs to be recognized. There will be growing challenges. This is the, I guess, the new normal to balancing privacy and security in the 21st century, largely because of things bleeding across international borders in ways that they didn't in the good old days, you know, 40 or 50 years ago. And it was easier to draw a distinction, which we'll come back to, between domestic and foreign intelligence. And that is something we're going to have to deal with. And as the president has said, you can't have full security and full privacy. There needs to be some intersection there. And I think that'll be a lively debate in the future. And a final point, this is not just about NSA. Other public and private international entities are engaged in the same kind of work. And I'll just give you a few statistics because I think they're illustrative. Let's see. Facebook has received requests from 74 different countries on data on more than 38,000 users just in the first half of this calendar year, including countries like Germany, France, and India. They've all approached it for that. Microsoft, you go on with the litany, has received law enforcement requests for information from France, Britain, Turkey, and Germany, just from those countries in excess of 10,000 users for each one just in the last 6 months. Google, in the second half of 2012, has had more than 20,000 requests of data from 31 countries, including countries such as Germany, France, Russia, and Taiwan, Twitter, and so on and so on. I mean, I could go right down the list. The important point on that, I think, is not so much the large volumes and the eaches and which countries are involved in this, but the for all of us in this room, before any of this happened, it was clear to any of us who had even rough knowledge of information technology and leave alone the intelligence community, that there was really no guarantees or assurances of privacy, aside from any governments, on things that you put on the internet. As someone told me many years ago, don't send an email or put anything on the web that you don't want to have on the front page of the Washington Post or you don't want to show to your mother. And that is not because of what we've seen recently, but it's, you know, good, sound companies, you know, I understand, and I'm not a technical expert, that when you send an email, it typically goes to around 6 or 8 different servers, typically in the United States, but maybe not in places like Canada and other countries. And take Microsoft, good company, well-led, fairly well-established. There is no guarantee that 10, 20 years from now, Microsoft's going to be able to protect all that information, which is stored permanently. This has nothing to do with government. But it does have to do with technology in the 21st century. And when you put things out there on the web of any type, especially if you're posting, I tell my students about this all the time, any photograph that you put on, you know, Twitter or Facebook, it's out there and it's out there permanently. And then there may be a situation, you know, 20 years from now where you don't want somebody to see that. So the broader issue, I think, is privacy and security in ways that have to do with the advances in technology. Part of this is the discussion on government that we need to have, but a lot of it isn't. Just has to do with where we are and changes that have taken place over the course of the last, really, 20 years based on technology. At the same time, we have some big issues in the intelligence community that are not related to the recent commotion, as I called it, and I'll just quickly list those in addition to balancing privacy and security. Probably the biggest one is the balance between what we call foreign intelligence and something that is really very alien to most Americans, domestic intelligence, which is a term that we normally don't use. And we are still not very good at what most people in foreign countries, like, to include even like the United Kingdom and Canada, regard as domestic intelligence. We don't do domestic intelligence well. And there's still a big gap between our international, overseas-based intelligence work and what we may do in terms of what it connects to the United States. There have been some changes, primarily in three entities that we don't have time to get into: the National Security Branch of the FBI, the National Counterterrorism Center, and the Department of Homeland Security, which are trying to do better at that. But the people that are, well, people like me and Keith Alexander, I worked with very closely as a counterpart for many years, both when we were military officers and afterwards. We have done all our work and made our careers overseas. People like Keith and I don't know anything about domestic law enforcement, what you know might be regarded as domestic intelligence. We did all our work in places like Iraq and Grenada, several operations in Haiti, the Far East, the Balkans, places. That is where we have operated. And we, from the time you start in this business, it is absolutely drilled into you that you are a foreign intelligence officer and you can't really do much of anything here in the United States. I mention that because other countries, quite frankly, and probably the UK is one example, probably do a better job of integrating foreign and domestic matters. And that's still a big split that we have, and but it's fraught with all kinds of implications for privacy, which we acknowledge. The broader, I could go into more details there. There are some resource and other issues that apply to national security and the intelligence community, but I think they will be resolved. And on the whole, the community, notwithstanding the recent issues, is actually working together as a team probably more effectively than they ever have, aside from some of the challenges that we have relative to a domestic and international fusion. Okay, before we go to your questions, which is the most important part, I'd just like to talk, as I said, about national security being at home and what it means for those of us here in Central New York. People in Central New York have a much closer connection to national, and for that matter, international security, than is widely realized. And I'll give you just a few examples of that. It really goes back to Fort Stanwix and Oriskany in 1777 and continues through the present day. And it's and the history of one of the things I have to do with the spring course that I teach at Maxwell, which is on defense and resources, is I take them down to Gettysburg for 2 days. And fortunately, we got a couple of Syracuse natives in that, and they always take us to Culp's Hill at Gettysburg, which is basically a Syracuse monument. But the right side of the Union line down there is all Syracuse regiments that did that in 1863 in July. Tremendous history. More recently, and also for Syracuse University, what transpired there in the 1940s was unbelievable. Just a couple of statistics I have to share with you. Between 1944 and 1948, the enrollment at Syracuse University expanded from 4,000 students to 20,000 students, including more than 600 temporary buildings through the winter months. Imagine being in a winter. Now, you see the photographs of these buildings. They don't look like they were very good, but they. Some may remember that here in the audience today. That was, of that expansion to 20,000, there were 10,000 veterans in that mix. So we had more veterans enrolled in Syracuse University in 1947 than any other university in New York State. And then Chancellor Talley and the work that he did in the 1940s to expand Syracuse, his implications right through the present day and into the future. As you know, we have a robust, and with the tip of the hat to Sandra, down at University College, a veteran center at the university. We also have the Institute for Veterans and Military Families, a national center, which is hosted at Syracuse University and Remarkable. We have important elements of industry here in Central New York, outfits like SRC and others that do a lot of very important work in the defense industry, not in the least in the counter-IED work that I got a chance to see firsthand repeatedly in Afghanistan and Iraq. And our Veterans Administration Medical Center, the VAMC, the VA hospital here in Syracuse. As you may know, Secretary Shinseki was here just about 3 months ago to commemorate their 50th anniversary, but also to commend them. There are 152 veterans hospitals in the United States, and ours was ranked number one of 152. Yeah. You see Director Cody around, because he's here from time to time. You might want to shake his hand and congratulate him. So. The point being that with this broader definition of national security that I talked to you about here today, ranging all the way from the economy, the environment, to healthcare, and things that we do, certainly related to education, that national security does begin at home. And a lot more of it begins at home right here in central New York than is probably widely appreciated, and that's something that we probably need to acknowledge more regularly. So thank you for your time, and I'll now take your questions.
And we have a few. Good. You know, I think I'm kind of an expert on intelligence, especially UK, because I think I've read all of the Jean Le Carré novels at one time or another. So I want to talk to you about that later.
Good morning. The question I had really goes to the active, permanent military, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, and the impact that it's had in the drawdown. I can remember the active Army. I was an Army guy. Over a million troops back in Vietnam time or whatever. We had peace dividends after that. Sequestration now, just kind of arbitrary across the board, a lot of cuts. So you're, even just the Army, I think, is under 500,000. I forget the numbers. What is the impact of the downsizing of that, using National Guard and Reserve to fight a lot of the war, particularly the last 12 years or so since 9/11, and the fact that we're not fighting countries anymore. It's the terrorists or whatever you want to call them that just wander and want to control other governments and things like that.
Yeah, great question. We're going through, and I try not to dwell too much on defense, but in fact, yesterday, the meetings I was at in Washington were all about just that, the drawdown of the five military services, including the Coast Guard. The Army is the one that's going to be the most important bellwether. It'll be somewhere in the 400,000s in terms of active duty strength, perhaps below 450. It could be as low as 420. We just completed what's called a strategic choices and management review by the Defense Department, in which they even threw out a number of 390,000 for the Army, which is too low, and everybody recognizes that. General Ray Odierno, the Chief of Staff of the Army, just received a report yesterday on 9/11 with a proposed range of choices that he could have for force structure of the Army across the defense program for the next 4 years. And some of the numbers, as I understand from people that were involved in that study, do take it down to somewhere in the mid-400s, with implications, as you said, for what the reserve component is going to look like, which would probably increase just a little bit, although that's not clear yet. The broader issue is also we'll probably be losing at least two or potentially three carrier battle groups for the Navy and all the associated ships that are part of that. The Marine Corps will get smaller probably by about 40,000 troops. The Air Force will probably lose about three air wings, which is the equivalent of about 16 squadrons of fighter aircraft. So there is a drawdown taking place. Now, the important thing as you do that is that you retain the core capabilities and, most importantly, that you retain the people. To look at it in fairly concise fashion, and as Secretary of Defense Hagel explained after the strategic review that was just completed, it's going to go in one of two directions, although there is a gray area between the two. It'll either be protecting force structure and having more soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marine, and Coast Guardsmen, and the bellwether for that will be the Army, and this would mean an Army of around 460,000, 470,000 active duty, and not doing as much modernization. Or the other option that we would have would be having a smaller force structure, somewhere down in the low 400s for the Army, which will be cut across the other services, and investing more in upgraded equipment and more modernization for the forces. Now, it may fall somewhere in between, but those are the big decisions that we're gonna have to make, because you can't retain the level of force structure that we've had across all the military services and do modernization at the same time with, and without getting too Maxwell on you, the defense budget next year is probably going to be about 475, down from a high of about 520 plus our overseas contingency operations. And you can't fund both of those, although everybody recognizes it needs to come down to about that level.
I'd sort of like to do a follow-up question on that. I think it was last spring we had Dr. Jabbour here talking about cybersecurity. And, of course, his big issue as an educator and an expert was getting young people interested and trained and trainable to be able to you know, man or woman the force is, because it's more, it's not force now. It is a lot of intelligence. And is that, do you see that as an issue of finding the people, not just the technology, but the people who can use the technology? Yeah.
Great question. I'll give you a two-part answer. The first part, which I think is perhaps most important, are the things that are really important in our military, and the reason why we are as good as we are, and we have a separate discussion about that. But it comes down to our people, the way that we are organized, and how we operate around the world under something called the Unified Command Plan with the combatant commanders and our joint structure within the military. It's not because we're bigger. It's not because we have more resources invested. It's not because, whether we want to or not, a lot of foreign nations want to use us as an example. It really has to do with the people. And that gets back to the previous question. We need to retain the most capable officers, enlisted civilian men and women that we have in the military. And we can do that. And that's a function of leadership. And that's something that we need to pay more attention to than ever during times of drawdown, where it's tougher. It's a little bit easier when you're expanding, but when you're drawing down, you've got to keep those people, and they've got to hang in, and retention is the key issue there. Now, the specifics on your question relative to cyber, that's a subset of that, but you need, you know, people that are also extremely capable at, you know, flying fighter aircraft, going to sea in terrible conditions and not getting seasick, doing things that the Coast Guard has to do for us every day, the Marines that are willing to put up with all kinds of physical rigor in ways that aren't for most people, and so on and so on. And those are the real discriminators. It comes down to the people we have and the dedication that they have to the military mission of the nation. Relative to cyber, I'll go out on a limb just a little bit here, and choose my words carefully. There are many core missions of the military. Cyber is not necessarily one of them. And one of the big debates that we need to continue to have, the Department of Homeland Security looms large here, is, you know, the relative weight of effort of who should have responsibility for cyber, certainly domestically, between the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense. That is a big issue, which is still out there, and there's many, many different opinions on that. A lot of people can do a cyber mission in private industry, domestically, and so forth, but only the military can do the military missions, the hardcore, tough war fighting that from time to time needs to be done. And hopefully we'll never lose our emphasis on that.
Good morning. I'm impressed with how well you're able to speak after that flight last night, but I know it's a regular problem. I have a two-part question. One is that Sandra mentioned that you are the former director of the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, otherwise known as NGA. And I don't know how many people here even know what that is. So that would be very helpful if you could explain what that agency does and what geospatial information is, number one. And then number two, you spoke about the domestic and foreign aspect of your interests here today. Could you talk about that role in the U.S., such as the Highfield Initiative and some of the other programs that are actually happening, and how those are actually resources for Syracuse, Central New York?
Yeah, great question. First, just a few words on NGA, something that it's the most important intelligence organization you've never heard of. The intelligence community, just quickly, is comprised of 16 elements, and it's the Big Six and the other 10. And the Big Six organizations are the ones that really comprise about 90% of the resources and people in the intelligence community. And they are the Central Intelligence Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the National Reconnaissance Office, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the National Security Branch of the FBI, and DIA, NSA, NGA, SBFBI, CIA, and let's see, another one of the Big Six. I feel like I'm the governor of Texas here all of a sudden. the National Security Branch of the FBI, National Reconnaissance Office, DIA, NGA, CIA, and NGA. I got them all six. They are the most important elements of the intelligence community. NGA is a very large organization as part of that, which is responsible for overhead and terrestrial collection of all things what are called geospatial, which is three components: imagery intelligence, imagery-derived intelligence, and also what's called mapping, charting, and geodesy, essentially mapping and charting in support of the primarily the armed forces, but other national missions. It's a very large organization based all over the world with people in more than 50 different locations, but primarily in the Washington, D.C. area and also in St. Louis, where one-third of our organization is located in two larger facilities, one in downtown St. Louis and one on the outskirts. NGA works very closely with other elements of the intelligence community, but the geospatial laydown that they are responsible for is absolutely vital to the workings of the intelligence community. And the work that NGA does ranges from some things which are highly classified, but a lot of which are not classified at all, to include especially assistance for humanitarian missions around the world. A big organization comprised of about 14,000 people. Relative to your second question, in terms of things that we can do domestically to help out, an important thing relative to oversight for the intelligence community is that anything that NGA does domestically is in support of a lead federal agency. No element in the intelligence community in terms of domestic support, as we did, for example, during Katrina, the Gulf oil spill, as we do during hurricane assistance, in terms of just providing geospatial laydowns of where things are and where they are not on a real-time basis, has to be in support of a lead federal agency. Typically, the LFAs that we support are NOAA, the FBI, the Coast Guard, but most of the time FEMA. Most of the time, the support that we do domestically at NGA is for FEMA. And Craig Fugate, the current FEMA director, has an extremely close relationship with us, and we provide what's called an NST, an NGA support team, which is fully vested at FEMA and provides support for them. We're not allowed to do anything domestically by ourselves unless it's with an LFA, to include the kind of missions that you mentioned, which, as I said, kind of cover a pretty broad swath, all the way from environmental, but probably the most attention that it gets is for disasters, ranging from wildfires to floods and to things of that nature.
So are they also allowing me to track my daughter's NOAA ship in the North Atlantic?
No. Okay. I can talk about ship tracking in detail, but that's based on a different life. That's not an NGA mission.
So. Okay, thanks. Question over here.
One of the reasons 9/11 occurred, presumably, is we were not very good at connecting the dots. Are we better at connecting the dots now?
We are, and in terms of two of the 9/11 hijackers had data, which was a resident in the FBI, which today would have been fused by the National Counterterrorism Center, the NCTC, which is the organization that came out of the what's called the 9/11 Commission, and following that, the Commission on Capabilities of the United States, the so-called WMD Commission. So that problem would have been solved, but it's still... as I mentioned earlier, there are still issues in terms of, you know, domestic intelligence, which is a kind of an oxymoron in the United States. It's not something that really we acknowledge or accept. And there are, you know, as we found a little bit, the Times Square bombing is probably not the best example. And the flight to Detroit that was almost exploded by a device that took place 6 years ago now, five. But we have not fully rectified the foreign and domestic pieces related to security, and I'll call it security because it's about more than intelligence. We made a big decision as a nation in 2004, which was largely, didn't get that much attention, but and part of it was related to a presidential election that was coming up, but in the rush to finish the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act, which was passed in 2004 and implemented in 2005, there was a raging debate within the Bush administration on the Hill, which some of us were involved in, on what our domestic intelligence organization should look like. And Bob Mueller, who was the director of the FBI at the time, who just stepped down after a very effective, more than 10-year term as the director, argued very strongly that not with the model that exists in the United Kingdom, for example, where they do have a domestic intelligence and security organization, that there would be this larger element called the National Security Branch within the FBI that would effectively do most of those roles, consistent with the formation of the Department of Homeland Security and the National Counterterrorism Center, as I mentioned earlier. And he won that argument. But there were a lot of people, like in 2003, 2004, leading up to that, especially on the Hill, that wanted to form a domestic security service in the United States. And the big decision that was made in 2004 is that you would expand this thing called the National Security Branch within the FBI, and the FBI would assume that role. And that's where we are today. And you can have a lot of, there's probably as many opinions on that as we have people in the room here this morning. But that's where we are today, and it's a step in the right direction, but it's probably not the final answer.
From a national security standpoint, how critical is the Snowden situation? And can you just comment about the possibility of more of this type of thing happening in the future?
Great question. Short answer, more significant than people realize, and yes, it is going to happen again. Let me elaborate upon that just a little bit. Aside from what you think about the information and how controversial you believe it is, the leakage represented by what happened in terms of what has been released already and what will continue to be released in the months and potentially years of the future is very, very serious. This is a bad, bad, probably one of the worst leaks we've had in many, many years. And the damage assessment, which you have to do, is kind of, you know, from a politically neutral standpoint, just look at the damage that's been done. It's extremely serious. And there's probably going to be more that will be dribbled out in the future. It's not over yet. And the part that can be most awkward is the implications, as we had with the Bradley Manning releases that came out in WikiLeaks, is the fact that it's not just about us. It never is, but we compromise a lot of foreign countries that work with us and then put them. You know, with the WikiLeaks releases, one of the parts of that that was toughest, and it was primarily a State Department issue and not a Defense Department issue, some of our closest allies had to reassign diplomatic personnel because of things that were released from what Bradley Manning had been able to pull out of the system, and compromised diplomatic personnel from some of our closest allies had to be reassigned. Those are the kind of implications that, you know, are tough to deal with. The second part of your question, you know, this is security in the era of big data. You know, people talk about big data all the time. One of the implications of big data is that you can have leaks on a huge scale, whereas, you know, in the quaint old days of 40 or 50 years ago, it tended to be more limited, usually driven by people that made, you know, copies of things or used, you know, micro cameras made in Rochester here or something. In the era of big data, it's a lot tougher, and these kind of system leaks that you can have are a big challenge.
Thank you. You said something earlier about our intelligence is related to our values or based on our values and our strategy. And that sounded really good to me, but then I began to wonder, well, what are our values? What are those values that we are linking it to? And again, maybe thinking about my fictional education, I think about the quaint old days of intelligence, and then now when, at least maybe I'm thinking of the military, but how it's become privatized, and that you know, industry and consultants seem to have as big a role as people who are military or civil servants. And is that an issue, a sort of privatization of military, and does that extend into intelligence?
It does. A two-part question. The first part, the values and interests, and I commend for all of you that actually read these things, we probably ought to pay more attention to. But, you know, the classes I teach in the Maxwell School, I force people to read the National Security Strategy. They actually have to read it. It's not hard. I think it's, I want to say, somewhere in the mid-20s, about 25 pages. And the section in our National Security Strategy on interests and values is a quick read, and one that I think is a good point of reference. The part of it has to do also with making sure that we, from an international standpoint, can be still, you know, there's nothing like, I was in Beirut many years ago, and it was a little bit safer there. And, you know, you turn the corner, and you go down, it's, you know, Rue John F. Kennedy Street. You know, and things that you see in Latin America, they're named after Franklin Roosevelt and so on. I mean, this keeping our values as a beacon as much as they can be around the world, and that's consistent with our interests. And I think there is a logical seam there, and the National Security Strategy actually does a pretty good job of explaining what that needs to look like. The second part, the civilianization of the some national security missions, because it applies not just to the military, but larger than that. I think there's a pretty broad sense that that needs to be put in control. Because of the budget drawdowns, it's happening almost automatically anyhow, I'll tell you specifically in the intelligence community, the contractor base is being shrunk much more quickly than the we call blue badgers, who are government personnel who work in the intelligence community. So I think part of that will be corrective. And part of that was sort of something that would only happen once, quite frankly, but big decisions that were made primarily in the Defense Department circa 2002, 2003 to outsource a lot of military missions. And I think that's unlikely to happen again. It was kind of a unique circumstance.
Glad to hear it.
As I'm listening to you talk about the intelligence community, I started thinking about foreign policy. Can you comment on the interaction or influence between intelligence and foreign policy?
Certainly. It happens at many levels. Probably the way that it happens, which is most important, is intelligence informing the decisions that we make for foreign policy. And that, you know, typically at the very most senior level happens in the Situation Room there in the West Wing of the White House, where both the Director of National Intelligence and the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency are at the table across from the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, and the Attorney General, and Secretary of Homeland Security, and so forth. I think in terms of kind of the international engagement, it's more about informing decisions, but also the EACHs, the personnel that we have assigned around the world, and also the separate engagement that the intelligence community has with counterpart services all over the world, because every country has an intelligence service. And believe me, some of them are not paragons of moral turpitude. I've had to deal with some of them. But they're, you know, it's called liaison in the business. But I mean, you also have, and it you wouldn't want to call it diplomacy, but you have engagement and intelligence channels across several countries. But I think I would describe that as the intelligence community in support of our foreign policy and in support of the State Department, and that happens on a consistent basis. In fact, the State Department has an outfit called INR, which is their own intelligence analysis arm that support the decisions that are made within the State Department.
John. When I think of the national security strategies, I think that one of the greatest ones that we saw after World War II for both the nation and the people was the GI Bill. What do you think is going to be the strategy after the Mideast settles down? What strategy is going to affect the nation and the people the most?
Geez, a great question. I think what's probably going to be the most important part of our strategy is, as Bob Gates used to say when he was the Secretary of Defense, is to have flexibility in our national security apparatus so we can respond pretty quickly to situations that are surprises internationally. Because we're not going to, as I kind of alluded to indirectly before, we're not going to do a very good job of predicting things in advance. And there will be surprises, big surprises around the world that whether we like it or not, we're going to have to deal with at some level, hopefully in a modest way, but at some level. Relative to the GI Bill, I think that is a key, you know, talking about a broader definition of national security, the GI Bill is part of our national security. Our son's going through medical school now on the GI Bill. I got my master's degree from Georgetown on the GI Bill. And the history of the GI Bill here in central New York and with Syracuse University is eye-watering. That's an absolutely essential part of our national security, consistent with the broader definition that we talked about earlier.
Yep. Bob, thank you for your extraordinary service. My question has to It builds off of John's a little bit, which is the concept of conscription, the draft. And I wonder if any of the circles you travel in, this topic is on anybody's agenda and what you could envision coming down the road in terms of that initiative. It's pretty much asleep today, and it has been for a while. Do you have any views on that or information sharing you could provide? Thank you.
Great question. It's probably not going to come back anytime soon, which is really too bad. One of the biggest problems that we have relative to the military in the United States is kind of the separation of the military from the majority of the population, over 90% of the people that don't have, like, you know, immediate family members in the military or haven't served in the military, which is a big change from where we were 50 years ago. And, you know, there are a lot of reflections in that. The number of members of Congress who have served in the military, which has actually taken a slight bump up, but it's still nowhere near where it was, say, in the 50s and 60s, as you might expect. The I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but the percentage of our population that is actually served in the military. And also, something else that's troubling is it has kind of become a family business. I mean, the statistics are overwhelming that people who do join the volunteer force from all five of the military services today tend to have parents, grandparents, and those that don't. And there are also some regional demographics which are not as widespread as they should be. Interesting, Central New York is very high for military service right through last year. I wish there was a way to have a truly representative military drawn from as diverse a population across all of the United States. And I think everybody also, and Colin Powell did some great work on this, wish there was some kind of mandatory national service, which could be in hospitals, could be in the Peace Corps, it could be in the military. And I think we would be better off for that, but I just don't see the political will right now to certainly reinstate the draft. I don't think that's likely. I think the broader issue that we need to work at, which we're behind on, is having some form of public service for all of our people and also a better understanding of the military across the entire population.
One last question.
Some folks say George Bush cooked the books on intelligence in Iraq, and some say that the worldwide intelligence community all were 100% in agreement on the intelligence in Iraq. Which is true?
Ooh, save the best question for last. I was around for much of that. I was on the joint staff at the time as the vice director for intelligence on the joint staff, although we were very heavily focused specifically on the military dimensions of what might be decided. There was, in 2002, a lot of push from across government, from the administration at that time, to do something about Iraq, period, regardless of any other circumstances. But regime change in Iraq was a goal of a lot of people in the administration, and notwithstanding what may or may not have happened. And a lot of these were people that had roles in the Bush 41 administration when, as they saw it, the conflict hadn't been brought to its conclusion. They had concerns about the Shia population in the South and the Kurds and a variety of other things. It had nothing to do with WMD, and it had nothing to do with whether or not Saddam Hussein had any additional chemical weapons capability in Iraq. The national intelligence estimate that came out in the first months of 2003 on Iraqi WMD was a fiasco. It was a bad document. It was single source through a German subsource, somebody named Curveball, you may have read about in the books. And it's a classic example of bad tradecraft, which is why we had the WMD Commission and why we reorganized the entire intelligence community in 2005, and why we stood up a Director of National Intelligence and all the other changes we've had, which resulted directly from that. Now, were the books cooked? I would tell you there was pressure from the administration to have a basis for military action in Iraq. Now, that took many different forms depending upon who you dealt with. Some were unconcerned about WMD. Some seemed to think that you needed that as a casus belli. And it varied widely, but I think most of that's in the public domain right now. And I would tell you from the standpoint of the military at that time, and particularly on the Joint Staff and U.S. Central Command, most of the focus was, you know, if we had to do something to make sure that it was done in a effective way. Specifically, I would tell you the way that WMD affected me most of all for what's called 1003 Victor, which was the invasion of Iraq in the spring of 2003, was making sure that if we needed it, we had it's called mop gear, enough mop gear for the soldiers in case there was any utilization of any kind of chemical weapons by the Iraqis. I say that because, you know, the military tends not to get too involved in these political discussions. It tends to be pretty practical, and that's the perspective that we had. But I'll end by what I started. There was a lot of interest in 2002 in doing something about Iraq and the administration, but the basis for doing that came from several different directions.
Thank you for your service. Thank you for being here with us today, Bob Moritz.